For over 10 years, VOC Nation has taken listeners behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history. Our hosts are not only experts on the business, but have lived in the business. Subscribe and hear weekly podcasts from hosts like legendary pro wrestling journalist Bill Apter, former Impact Wrestling star Wes Briscoe, former WWE and AWA broadcaster Ken Resnick, former WWE and TNA star Shelly Martinez, former WCW star The Maestro, NWA legend The Raging Bull Manny Fernandez, and much more. VOC Nation programming is free on most major podcasting apps, including iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Radio.com. And video podcast and bonus content is available on Patreon for as low as $3 a month. What are you waiting for? Head to VOCNation.com and dig into the most comprehensive podcast network built for pro wrestling fans. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at VOC Nation Wrestling Network and follow us on Twitter at VOC Nation.
Thank you for joining another edition of Bumps and Thumps, the talk of wrestling. I'm your host, Brian Ferguson. My guest today is a legend in the tag team division. He started in pro wrestling in the grueling class of 1972 at Vern Gagne's wrestling camp with legends like Greg Gagne, Ric Flair, Ken Patera, the Iron Sheik, and Bob Bruggers. He wrestled in the American Wrestling Association from 1972 until 1985. While competing in the AWA, he teamed up with Greg Gagne, where they were known as the High Flyers, and won the AWA World Tag Team Championship on two different occasions and were voted Tag Team of the Year in 1982 by the fans of Pro Wrestling Illustrated. In 1985, Jim signed with the WWF and teamed up with B. Brian Blair to form the Killer Bees. He continued to wrestle in the independent circuits until he retired from the ring in 1999. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome one half of the legendary High Flyers and Killer Bees, Jumpin' Jim Brunzell. Jim, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be on Bumps and Thumps.
My pleasure, Brian. I like the name of it, Bumps and Thumps.
I had to come up with something original, you know. Yeah, a lot of those names are taken, so.
Yeah, it sounds pretty apropos.
All right. Well, I'd like to get into first about you growing up, your family life as a child and schooling. So I read your book, Matt Lantz. Great book, by the way. Great book.
Thank you.
Easy read. I was telling my wife, you know, I like all the pictures. Guys like pictures. A couple pages and you get some pictures, which is nice. So it's an easy read. It's a good read. So just tell us a little bit, if you could, about your growing up and your family life and your schooling.
Well, I was born, my mom and dad were local St. Paul, Minnesota kids, and my dad was a naval pilot, and he was a career Navy man. So in my early life, I have a sister who's 2 years older than me, Kathy, and we traveled all over. I mean, I was out in the Marshall Islands in 1955 in what they call Kwajalein Atoll. And it was – right now it's a Nike Zeus missile base, but at that time the Navy used it as a base for air sea rescue in the South Pacific, okay. Marshall and Mariana Islands. So we're out there for a year, and then I went to California, lived there for a year, wound up living in Memphis, Tennessee in 1958. That's where I saw Elvis Presley. And I told my dad, I said, I want to be just like him. Yeah. And I freaked my dad out, so he took me to the music store a couple weeks later, and he bought me an accordion. So needless to say, I replaced the accordion with a football, and I focused all my attentions on sports. So, you know, we moved back to Minnesota, and I think it was 59. I went to St. Jude's parochial Catholic grade school, and then I went to Hill High School for 2 years, and I transferred to White Bear Lake. I played football, basketball, hockey, baseball, and track, and then at White Bear, I just played football, basketball, and track. I was indoor and outdoor state high jump champ. I was pretty successful on the football field, and our team – on the basketball team fell one game short of making it to the state tournament in 1967. So I was blessed to have a lot of good athletes with me at White Bear High School. And then from there, I wanted to play college football and wanted to be a golfer. So I walked on. And that was 1967. And that's where I met Greg Gagne.
Yeah.
He was a walk-on quarterback from Mound, Minnesota. And he and I actually teamed up pretty good together, and we became fast friends, and that's where I met Vern, and this went on. And Greg wasn't going to play quarterback at the University of Minnesota, so he transferred to Wyoming. Mm-hmm. And then we didn't see each other again until actually after my senior year at the University of Minnesota, I played a year of semi-pro football in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. Ah. And then from there, I had an invitation to go to the Washington Redskins. They had a three-day tryout, rookie tryout camp. And I went there, didn't make it, came back and thought I was going to go to school and finish. I had like 31 credits, get my degrees. So lo and behold, shortly before that, Greg calls me and he says, "Hey, my dad's having a wrestling camp with Ken Patera. And he wants to know if you want to try." And I thought, geez, Greg, I said, the only wrestling I did was intramurals. And he said, "Ah, don't worry about it." So I took a chance and I thought, well, it's something athletic. And little did I know, if somebody would have asked me when I was 18 years old, Brian, if I would have spent 25 years being a pro wrestler, I thought I would have told them they were crazy.
Yeah.
So that's what happened. And, you know, we had this camp and it was a real tough camp, and I think it was like 8 or 10 weeks long, and it was 4 to 6 hours a day, and it was like 5 days a week. And Vern and Billy Robinson, just, you know, we did calisthenics and all different sorts of things. But I remember we used to do these Hindu free squats, which was a deal of Billy Robinson's. And we got up to doing 1,000 free squats a day, 10 sets of 100. And my legs, I mean, I felt like I could jump up and touch the top of the barn. My legs were so big and powerful. Damn it. You know, it was unbelievable. And then shortly, I think in December of 1972, I had a match with Dennis Stamp in, I think it was Moorhead, Minnesota. And it was a 15-minute draw. Okay. And I came in, I was so frustrated because I just, you know, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And I remember I kicked this trash can and Dusty Rhodes was there, and Dusty sort of looked at me, you know, and Dusty had a little bit of a lisp, and he said, "Jimmy," he said, "don't worry, you'll have a lot of stinkers." Little did I know he was correct. So that, you know, and from then on, I mean, when you're a pro wrestler, I mean, it's, it was some matter of fact, they sent me to Kansas City and I wrestled with Mike George.
Okay. Yeah.
In the summer of 73 in the 74. And Mike and I were the Central States tag team champions. Okay. And we wrestled Roger Kirby and, Lord Alfred Hayes. And, I remember, what's his name? Bob Orton Sr. was there. Uh-huh. And Danny Little something or other, but Bob Geigel and Pat O'Connor were the promoters. So I was there for a little bit, and then it was time to bring me back, and I started, you know, back in late 74 with Greg in the AWA.
Yeah, now I'll tell you, when I was a kid, I can remember – watching you guys with your tie-dye trunks. And I'll tell you a quick story. My dad, he absolutely, I don't know if you talked to Greg lately, but I told him the same story that he would not, if he was in the room, he would not let us allow us to watch wrestling. So my mom and my grandma knew I really enjoyed it. So they would distract him by, "Hey, can you do this or whatever?" And so then they'd turn the channel because you didn't have cable back then. It was, you know, antenna. So I'd go and watch it. And then if he started coming back in, they'd try to distract him a little bit. Or I'd go to my grandma's house my grandma, you know, grandmas, they'll do whatever you want pretty much. And I just loved it. You watching you and Greg wrestling, and just the whole show itself was just great. I really enjoyed it. You know, that's what I think is a lot is missing today is the storylines, the, you know, what the buildup of the.
Well, there is no storylines now.
Right.
You know, really. I mean, and I don't want to be too critical of, you know, what I see on TV. I don't watch it very much anymore, but
right.
I want to tell you, we have something in common because my mom and dad wouldn't let me watch wrestling on TV either because it interfered with Lawrence Welk. So that was their favorite, that and Gunsmoke. So that was right during the AWA, you know, time. So I couldn't watch it. But, it was, you know, getting into wrestling and then, you know, being in the AWA and
yeah.
and seeing all these stars learning really the business the way yeah. I think it should be. And everybody who was in the AWA, I mean, those guys were so incredibly talented. I mean, yeah. I'd been to, you know, I'd wrestled in Kansas City, and they had some talent there. You know, Jack Briscoe used to come in, and Terry Funk used to come in, and Dory Funk used to come in, and Harley was there, Harley Race. And then in 79, I went down to North Carolina for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And Ricky Steamboat and Ric Flair. And I mean, they had a Jimmy Snuka mm-hmm. and they had some great talent there. But when you think of the talent that was in Minneapolis, holy smokes. And the great thing about Minneapolis, Brian, was you had time off.
Yeah.
I mean, because, you know, seasonal, you know, we had a horrible winter here and people, Vern realized that people didn't want to go inside during the summer. So,
right.
you know, we only worked 10 to 12 times during June, July, and August.
Yeah.
Whereas in, you know, Carolina and Kansas City and New York, you work 7 days a week.
Yeah.
You know, it was just unbearable.
Yeah, I can. Yeah. I want to talk about that a little bit more with you. You know, you said you didn't wrestle before. So when you went to that camp and you talked about the calisthenics and stuff, and I – and what was the – process for you like with I mean did you I know that talk I know I've heard the story about Ric Flair quitting the first day or whatever. Did you ever think about, you know, I don't know if this is for me, anything?
Well,
like
I knew I was a pretty fair athlete, and yeah. I thought, you know, if I could withstand, you know, them the, like Billy Robinson would hurt you. I mean, mm-hmm. He would, you know, he was a king of submission, and he'd hook you every which way and, you know, make you yell. And I figured, well, if I can get by him, yeah. you know, I can do it. Because, see, it was funny because Vern and Billy, what they did was they never smartened you up. So you didn't know anything about the inner connections or how wrestling worked. So we're sitting there all the way up until just about a week before we're going to have our first match. Thinking, well, this is this and this is that. And, you know, deep in the back, you think, well, something's got to be. And then finally, you know, they broke the news to us. And then, you know, like Vern says, well, you're in the ring and you protect your opponent and your opponent protects you. Mm-hmm. So that was basically what we tried to do every night
right.
for years. And then, the real art of it is to make it look as real as possible, which it was real.
Right.
And then you paint that little hesitation in people's minds, say, geez, you know, I don't know, you know. And so, you know, I was very fortunate.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't really have any really bad injuries, except I wound up getting a staph infection from playing in a celebrity softball game. And
yeah.
I was out 6 weeks, and they actually took our belts away. And
I was going to ask you about that. Can you kind of elaborate on what happened with that?
Well, we were playing a celebrity softball tournament, and we were playing a hockey team, and Philadelphia was there, and it was a big fundraiser for something. And we played the Vikings, and we played We didn't play any – the baseball we're playing then, but we played Philadelphia Flyers and the Vikings and somebody else, and we wound up winning the tournament. We won the thing. And I was playing third base, and I went to dive for a ball, and I like a numbskull. It was hot that day, and I wore shorts. So I had a big raspberry on the side of my outside of my shin. And I didn't think anything of it. You know, I just put water on it. And then that afternoon we went swimming in a pool. And a day and a half later, my leg swelled and I didn't feel too good. And I went to the doctor and they said, geez, you got a staph infection. So I had, I don't know, two or three shots every day of penicillin. And then this doctor says, you can't wrestle. So they worked the deal with Vern, and then Vern says, well, Jim and Greg are going to have to, you know, give up their belts, and they had a little deal, and somewhere down the line we wrestled whoever it was. I think it might have been Jack Lanz and Bobby Duncan who had won the tournament, and then we wound up beating them. So, they, you know, for everything that happens, there's always a way to incorporate it into the storyline.
Okay. Well, that's interesting because I always thought you broke your leg.
Nope.
No, you did not break your leg. So there we go. We got some clarification.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, I'd like to get into, if I could, your travel experiences, guys you traveled with, kind of any interesting or odd stories you may have.
Well, you know, I've had people read my book and say, Jim, you're lucky you're alive.
Yeah, I've read it. And that's true.
Because there was times, you know, like when we, you know, Vern had this small plane, this 59919er, and this ex-Air Force pilot would fly through, you know, he'd fly through thunderstorms, and poor Bobby Heenan and I'd sit in the back, and we'd drink a box of wine on the way to the matches because we were petrified, you know.
Yeah.
I remember one time, this is the honest to gospel truth. This guy wouldn't deviate a mile and a half from 2 points, and he'd fly on the side of the, you know, these thunderstorms, and we'd hit this updraft, and we'd go up, you know, about, you know, we only could fly at 6,500, you know, feet because it wasn't pressurized, and I think 8,000 was the cap. And all of a sudden, we'd go up to about 9,000, then we'd go back down, and Bobby Heenan would just be sucking on that wine, and he'd say, oh, Jesus, and we'd be holding. And then I'll never forget, this was something that happened on the way back from Denver. We're flying back, and we had a headwind, and it was just – and we're running out of gas. And, so we – the only – place that we could stop was this Air Force base, and I think it was in South Dakota, and it had a real long runway because that's the only – because it was foggy, and this allowed us to land. So here it was. It's a secured base. So we come in and land, and we taxied over, and we pulled over, and two Jeeps came, and these guys had, you know, machine guns. They were military guys. So we opened up the door, and this guy comes in, and Bobby was drunk, Heenan, and he says, take me to your leader. And the guy says, shut up. You know, I'll ask the question. So that was one little incident. And then, cripe, we were flying that damn thing, and then Roy Bradley, the pilot, forgot when he checked the oil, he forgot to put – screw the oil cap on, and we were flying at about 6,000 feet, and the right wing was completely covered in oil. It sucked the oil out, so we had to have a emergency landing. I can't remember if it was Moline. We were going to Peoria, it was just one thing after another, and I remember Pompero Furpo, we were talking, and we had a meeting and talking about the plane, and Vern, you know, here's the ironic thing of it. Vern had this plane, and what he would do, he would take money off the top. Say, for instance, it cost $1,000 to fly the plane to Denver. Mm-hmm. So he'd take $1,000 off the top of Denver for the plane expense, and then he'd take $100 out of each one of our checks for flying on the plane.
Oh.
So he had a double duke, so he was making money. And then I found out that he had every seat insured on that plane for $1 million, and he was a benefactor.
Oh, no.
So I told my wife, I said, if we ever go down in the plane, I said, sue for $1 million, because that's what he's got on my head. So, wow. You know, Vern was always the ultimate businessman, and
yeah.
And he always felt that he was getting cheated.
Yeah, I've heard that. Heard that from.
I bet you didn't hear it from Greg, though.
No, I did not.
No.
No, well, you know, it's his father. Yeah, of course not.
That's right. Who would think?
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about chemistry. I know you chemistry with, you know, you had Greg, obviously with Greg and B. Brian Blair, but maybe some other guys in the ring that you worked with. Did you ever have, you know, like, did you feel like, oh, this is a guy I've always, I could work with?
You know, oh, gosh, there was a lot of guys like that. Mm-hmm. I was very fortunate because Nick Bockwinkel was incredible. Oh, God, he was great. And there was so many guys. Bobby Orton Jr. Yeah. Was incredible. There was so many guys. Rick Steamboat was incredible. Yeah. I mean, there was so many guys that really were incredible, mm-hmm. you know, talents.
Yeah.
And it was funny because it was a given in the AWA because everybody knew their situation. So when every night you'd have a hell of a match, whereas when you went to New York, I mean, everybody was trying to fight for, and nobody wanted to give anything. And it was just like pulling teeth. It was, and then I, and God rest his soul. I hate to mention this, but probably the worst person I ever worked with. There was two people who were really harder than hell. One was Cosro, the Iron Schnook, I call him.
And, I like it.
Yes. And then the other, God rest his soul, was Jim Neidhart.
Oh yeah. Okay.
He was a baby bull. You know, he was 5'9" and 270, and he was wired all the time.
Yeah.
And he was impossible in the ring to work with. He was, you know, 99 miles an hour, and you know, he was so afraid. I got to tell you what happened. I told him, I said, Jim, don't be afraid of my drop kick. It's stiff, but I said, if you put your hand up by your face, when you come off the ropes, you know, it'll hit your hand and just, you know, take a bump. So, time for me to throw the drop kick. I throw him in, and as I'm up in the air and I go to extend my feet, he pulls away from me, and he falls down, and the heel of my boot hit him right underneath the eye and put a big gouge in his eye.
Oh,
and it started to bleed. And he got up, and he was filling the air with left hooks. And
man.
I said, Brett, get in here right now, Bret Hart.
Yeah.
And he was just, you know, he was just hard, too hard to work with. And I know that, you know, he had some, you know, some personal problems and substance abuse. And it was just too bad because there was a good side of him, but it was just so hard to work with.
Yeah. What about working with the Road Warriors? You know, I watched a match the other day with you and Greg versus them two, and I've heard.
Horrible.
That's what I've.
You know, and I realize, you know, Joe and Mike, God rest his soul, they had their place in this business.
Mm-hmm.
And they were formed by Ole Anderson. Okay. And Ole Anderson, who was down in Atlanta at that time, got them together and made them into the image and likeness that he would picture himself to be. Mm-hmm. Somebody who was physically, you know, intimidating as hell,
right,
could talk, and then went in the ring. Not only could he talk what he was going to do, but then go in the ring and beat the shit out of you.
Yeah.
And that's the way the Road Warriors were.
Yeah.
And I remember Joe saying, we're the greatest tag team in all the world ever. And I says, well, I said, Joe, I said, it's easy to be that way when you go out and tell you're going to beat the shit out of somebody and do it every night after night after night after night and don't sell, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, we had a couple matches with them, and
they looked pretty rough.
I remember Mike says, hey, Jimmy, he said, I'm not going to take a bump on your drop kick. And I said, okay, I won't take a bump on your clothesline. Oh, right. Yeah. And I said, yeah, you know, yeah. You know, they just,
yeah,
you know, they made a lot of money and
yeah.
I see Joe at the shows and, you know, they had their place, but I certainly wouldn't say they were the greatest tag team of all time.
Yeah, they're pretty rough around the edge. I mean, I loved them as a kid, you know, because when I was a kid, you know, they'd go in and kick the crap out of everybody. Yeah, kick the crap out of everybody.
They hurt you. They didn't care.
Yeah. And then, you know, as I'm older now, I realize that those guys are pretty rough, and I'm sure a lot of wrestlers didn't care to work with them too much. Yeah.
Very much. Now, they're the same what Brock Lesnar is today. Brock, who I met when he was a junior in college.
Yeah.
Real nice kid.
Yeah.
Now he gets in there. He just beats the daylights out of these guys, and he doesn't care about them. You know, he flips them around, throws them around. He doesn't care if he hurts them. And that bothers me because those guys have put, you know, him over for the past, you know, 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
And it's through their grace that he's accomplished what he has.
Yeah.
You know, because I guarantee you, Brian, no matter how tough you are in any sport, you're always going to meet somebody. And it's funny because I talk about Haku, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and I mean, he straightened out everybody. I mean, nobody ever gave him guff because he'd bite their nose off. He wouldn't care who you were. He would.
Yeah.
We were in a bar in Cleveland. And it was this slaughter who was a wide receiver for the Cleveland Browns at a bar. And we were in there, and it was Brian Blair, myself, and Haku, and I think there was somebody else. And there was four offensive linemen that were from the Browns there, and they were sitting, and we were sitting at the bar, and you could hear them, ah-ha, that phony wrestling, blah-blah-blah, you know. So Haku was drinking cognac with a Coke chaser. Mm-hmm. So he's had about four of them, and he says, ah. So he puts down the Coke. He walks up to the table, and these guys are big, you know. I mean, they're all close to 300 pounds. And he says, fellas, he says, we're at the bar having a good time. I know you guys want to have a good time. And he says, but I want to tell you this. He says, if I hear any more shit about wrestling, there's going to be trouble. Mm-hmm. And he looked at them, and they didn't say a word. He went back. That was silent. They didn't say one thing, and I thought, "Oh God, thank you."
Yeah.
Because he was a. Ooh.
Yeah, I've heard.
If you offended him, I mean, you paid almost with your life.
Yeah.
I mean, he jammed his thumb in Jesse Barr's eye in Canada, and that was it for Jesse Barr. He was done.
Yeah. Wow.
And I mean, you know, and he bit a guy. Bit a guy's nose off in a fight. Yeah, there were four of them. Yeah, he cuffed one guy with a chop and hit another guy in the side of the neck, and the other guy started to get up. He dove across the table and bit the end of the guy's nose off and spit it in his face, and the guy went into shock. And I think it cost – I think he told me that he had lawsuits $500,000 to $700,000.
Oh, my goodness.
Against him.
Wow.
For fights.
Wow.
Yeah, he was the one you, yeah.
You don't want to mess with him.
Oh, God, no.
You're not the only one I mean, Greg talked about him on our podcast, and I've heard when I listen to other podcasts, they say you don't mess with Haku. I think Harley Race was another one I've heard.
Well, Harley was different in that you know, he would he had a pretty good left hook. I mean, the toughest guys that I, you know, Haku and then Dickie Slater, who passed away a number of years ago. He was oh, God, could he throw a left? And there was a couple guys, but still Haku by far.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing.
And he's a great family guy, great dad. And I see him, you know, and I see him a couple times, and he's just, you know, he was 6'3", 295 pounds, and he could kick his right leg up almost parallel, you know, perpendicular to the, just whoom, like a split, you know?
Yeah. Wow.
I remember I worked with him in Japan, Brian, He was 18 years old, and you don't know what's going on. Nobody was communicating. I came off the ropes, and he hit me in the head with the drop kick, and damn near knocked me out. And I said to him, "I'm supposed to give those to you." And he looked at me like, "What?"
Oh, that's funny. I was going to talk to you about that. So wrestling, it's all today pretty much all choreographed. Predetermined, whatever. Now, so, even how you talk and how you do your interviews and all that. And I know, and I talking to Greg last time on the last podcast, he said it wasn't anything like that. You guys went out, you said what you said. It was from your mind. Your matches, I asked him about that. I said, did you guys ever talk to your opponents prior to your match? Hey, this is what we're kind of looking at doing. And he said, no, not really. And I just wanted to get your perspective on that. I mean, did you ever, not say predetermined, but I'm saying, hey, at this point I might give you a drop kick, so be prepared or something like that.
Yes.
Okay.
The whole match was planned.
Okay.
I mean, here's what happened. The most important part of the match is the finish.
Mm-hmm.
So what precedes the finish builds the match.
Right.
So what you have is you have a series of the babyface getting over on the heel, and then finally the heel can't cope with it, so he falls the babyface. So he, in turn, is following the babyface and gaining more heat with the crowd. Mm-hmm. So then when the babyface makes the big comeback, that's when you go into the finish. So the most important thing is the finish. So, and a lot of the times, and the most important finish for a heel is not to beat the babyface 1, 2, 3. The heel's got to foul the babyface. He's got to do something. He's got to put his foot on the rope, 1, 2, 3. He's got to jab him in the throat or poke him in the eye, because if he beats the babyface, 1, 2, 3, with a wrestling move, that's the end of the story. He got the babyface, who is supposed to be better scientifically against the heel. If he gets – and that used to drive me crazy with Vince, because – he used to be – I remember the last year I was there, and I needed the work. He made me do jobs, for a number of guys, and I was really – oh, God, I was really – it hurt me so bad, but I had to do it because, I needed the money.
Right.
And I remember I they had me on TV, and it was Randy Savage, and he had Scary Sherry. And you can look this match up. We had a hell of a match, and I remember the first series. I had his arm, and something happened, and he comes off the rope, and I hit him in the mouth with the drop kick, and he came up spitting blood, and I thought, oh boy, here we go. and it was a heck of a match, and I remember, I'm trying to think of what TV it was, but I remember going out of the ring and walking through the curtain. Randy was there. And Vince McMahon came up to us, and he said, that was the best TV match I've ever seen.
Oh, wow.
And I'm sure he was just blowing smoke up my ass, but it was sort of nice, because I thought it was, too. It was a good match. And I recommend that match occasionally when, Randy was, he was excellent in the ring, too.
Yeah.
It was just too bad, he died so young. Ooh.
Yeah, it was had a heart attack, right? And then crashed his vehicle. Yeah, Now I heard with Randy, great person. But I heard that he had to have everything very detailed prior to. Like he said, we're going to do this, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And if it didn't go that way, he got a little upset. Did you ever experience that or no?
Well, I think he was pretty easy to work with because, his old man was a hell of a worker too.
Yep.
And, his brother too was good. And then, when you come, second generation, and I think, Randy was very conscious of being taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
And he had seen that, he wrestled down in Memphis and down in Nashville and in Kentucky, you know, where they, I mean, they're not noted for being real honest down there in terms of their booking and what have you. And I think Randy's upbringing, you know, with his dad told him never to trust nobody, you know, period. Yeah. And I think Randy approached everything in the world that way. And you know something? He never bought anything on credit. He paid cash for everything. Bought a condo down in Largo, paid cash. He had a Cimarron Cadillac. I don't know. I think it was like 40-some thousand. Paid cash for it.
Oh, wow.
And then when he was on the road, he and Elizabeth and his brother would share a room, you know, to cut down on an expense, and then they'd have a pizza, you know, and he never drank. I think he might have smoked a little bit, but I never saw him. You know, he was, you know, saved a lot of money.
Yeah. That's interesting. See, I learned something new here today about the Macho Man. So let's talk about some of the guys. You know, you said you did some jobs. So
yep.
Let's talk about jobbers that you worked with that in the AWA and WWE that put you over. I remember Kenny J. I remember Tom Rocky Stone, those guys.
Sure. Yep. Jake the Snake, or Jake the Milkman.
Jake the Milkman Milliman. Yeah.
Well, see, those guys are so important to have because they build the show, you know, and occasionally the promotion would have a, you know, a big match on TV, but there was nothing decided in that match, whether it be, you know, some outside interference or the guy take off. So they build it for the show that they were promoting. But, you know, you couldn't, you needed somebody in the ring, you know, that knew what he was doing and could make you look good.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the whole deal with TV wrestling, and they've shied away from that now, you know, to the point where, you know, I mean, there's hardly any finishes that I see, and then, you know, I see guy comes into the ring and he grabs a microphone, then the other guy runs into the ring, grabs a microphone, and then another guy comes in and jumps him, and then another, and you know, and and I see these, you know, 6- and 8-man tag matches, and I think, oh my God.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that. You know, I'm almost 50, and I've seen a huge shift in the television production. It's a lot of, you know, before you had, you know, you knew who Jake the Milkman Milliman was. Was he going to lose? Yes, probably 99% of the time. Mm-hmm. But you know who he was? You know, the Mulkey brothers down in Georgia during the 80s, Mulkey Mania. They had that for a while. And now it's just – it's very hard for somebody at a mid-card or level to get recognized. I mean, because they're not on TV. It's all main event guys.
Right.
They slap the mic – like you said, they slap the mic in their hand, and then there's another guy comes out that's the main eventer. And I think that's hurt the business. I don't know what – you know, I haven't watched it as much lately either, and that's just because – there's not fans there. There's not that crowd charisma. You know, you get into the crowd. I mean, you know, I've never wrestled, but I've been to events, and the wrestlers in the ring feed off of the crowd.
Exactly.
And you don't have that now. You got cut out cardboard and audio, and it's just not the same. They don't look comfortable. They don't look excited. I just think nowadays, I mean, you can elaborate too, that it's not much of a build of a show anymore. It's, you know, who's going to win. And there's no chance.
See, Vince's whole idea, his concept of pro wrestling was totally, he wanted to put the old style wrestling completely out of it. And he wanted to project his wrestling as superstars. Mm-hmm. So this is what he did. He projected a group of guys that were superstars that he could take and monetize in terms of, you know, whatever, T-shirts, dolls, everything. And then that's where his wealth came from. I remember, I mean, Hulk Hogan, Terry Bollea. This was during 84, 85, 86. And his wife, Linda, was telling us he was making $50,000 a week in royalties.
Holy
every
cow.
Week. 50 grand.
Wow.
Every week. And then he was getting $1 million for pay-per-view. So at that time, there was four or five.
Yeah.
Five.
Wow.
And then he was getting 12% of the gate when he wrestled. So here's what happened. I have this someplace, and it's a Sports Illustrated. And it had Hulk Hogan on a big facial picture of him, and it said, America's top banana, highest paid athlete, $10 million he made in a year, in 1985.
That's big money.
That was huge.
Yeah.
And you know, he was the golden goose, though. They couldn't have done it without him. And,
right.
And the great thing about Terry was that he could work. I used to watch him in Japan. God, he'd get down. You know, for a guy 6'6 and 300 pounds, he could get roll around on the guy and do all sorts of, you know, wrestling maneuvers that, you know, he worked with Inoki. And I mean, you know, and then finally, you know, when he got to the WWE, he realized, God, all I have to do is, you know, do this and do that. And the next thing you know, the people were eating out of his hand. And, you know, he was incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as a kid, he was one of my favorite guys. I mean, I ain't gonna lie. I used to have that poster of him flexing his muscles. I mean, he's quite a person, quite a wrestler. Working with up and coming talent. So I'm sure you worked with some guys that, you know, when you were a main eventer that you had to. Is there anybody that sticks out to you now that maybe was a up and coming and became a main eventer with you, working with you?
Not really, because the talent, you know, is so drastic from the AWA, everybody, you know, there was only like 12 guys and everybody knew their positions. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they would interchange, you know, maybe out of those 12 guys, 4 to 6 guys on main event, you know, during the course of the week at different towns. And there were guys, though, that I saw in the ring that had a lot of potential. Mm-hmm. And they just hadn't come, you know, come into their own yet. And, you know, it's hard to point out. They had a couple guys, Jimmy Powers, Paul mm-hmm. Roma, you know, who looked the part. And and to be honest with you, I Shawn Michaels was a natural, and he was really undersized, really, for, you know, doing what he did. But he was very good in the ring, and I had a hell of a match with him in Madison, Wisconsin on TV. Can't remember what year it was, but geez, we had a hell of a match, and he was fun to work with. And another guy who I sort of lost respect for, in that he had been a journeyman in his early career, and then he wound up having a hell of a spot in the WWE, and that was Ted DiBiase when they made him a $1 million man.
$1 million man, yeah.
The $1 million man with Virgil was supposed to be Jim Crockett and Dusty Rhodes. That was a $1 million man with Virgil Reynolds. So it was a parody that Vince put together. So, Teddy, you know, this was really the first time Ted was a good worker.
Yeah.
And he had struggled in Louisiana and Oklahoma and Texas. And all of a sudden, you know, he comes to New York and they gave him a hell of a run. So I remember we wrestled in Omaha, Nebraska, and Omaha was a big, AWA town, and I had a nice following there.
Right.
So we were supposed to have a match, and he was supposed to get by me on slip, something, and boom, beat me.
Yeah.
And during the course of the match, I was supposed to have a comeback. Well, out of the clear blue sky, all of a sudden he says, forget the comeback. And then he goes to beat me after he beat me to the ground for 8 to 10 minutes, and then he covered me. I was furious. I mean, I came about that close to ever having a locker room fight, and it would have been with him.
Oh, wow.
And I was so upset with him. And to this day, I tell him about it, and he goes,
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I just found out, that he and his son got in trouble cashing $2 million worth of charitable money organization, getting a grant. Did you hear that?
I heard something.
Deal?
Wow. No, I thought it was something else, but that's probably it. I thought it was counterfeiting or something, but you're probably.
No, it was taking money, and they were a nonprofit organization, and they had – asked for money for something, and they got like $2 million. And I think they indicted this kid.
Oh, no. Wow. I think I'm thinking of the counterfeiting. I'm thinking of Blackjack Mulligan and Barry Windham. That was years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. That's too bad. Yeah. Wow. All right. Well, let's talk about managers.
Okay.
Move on a little bit. So, you discussed Bobby Heenan a little bit.
Yeah, the greatest.
Yeah.
No comparison. Nobody. Nobody can compare with, Jimmy Hart, not even a hair on the back of Bobby's neck.
Yeah. How about Lord Al Hayes?
Lord Al Hayes was a great commentator, and he had that what would you call it, that air of nobility that he interjected so well.
Yeah.
And I remember him, working in Kansas City, and then he came to Minneapolis for a little bit, and then he actually worked in the office at the WWE for 20 years, behind the scenes. And he was, he was great, and he was a babyface to begin with, and then he didn't – he had all that Wigan style, Billy Robinson and Les Thornton and Jeff Ports, that in and out type of, wrestling that was so incredible to watch,
Yeah.
And he was good. Bobby was so, I remember one time Bobby, he had four or five people that he walked out, with on, in WrestleMania three, he had Andre, and he had a couple other people, and he was just so. And, Bobby only had an eighth grade education.
I did not know that.
What really killed Bobby was he could barely read. And then they threw these, 10 pages of interviews at him at the end, and he couldn't do it. He says, please, just let me go out there.
Yeah.
And he was so frustrated by that.
Yeah.
And he and I were very close. Matter of fact, we'd get together when my wife and I, we'd been going to Florida for 45 years down by Venice, and he had a beautiful place off of Bradenton, and beautiful. I mean, the pool went into the house, and it was just gorgeous.
Oh, wow.
And his daughter had a horse and everything, and we'd go there, and we couldn't really socialize out in public, but he was just wonderful. I mean. I got to tell you a quick story.
Please.
So we're up at the Indian Reservation, at Red Lake Indian Reservation, and the heels and the baby faces. Vern has taken us, all of us, there's about 14 of us, and we're going to go fishing at Lake of the Woods across the border. So we got two or three motorhomes. So I'm working with Bobby Duncombe in a match in Red Lake Indian Reservation, and these poor Native Americans were watching our match, and you could hear a cricket, and we're doing everything. I mean, we're trying everything, and nobody was buying nothing,
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, Bobby Heenan's got my head over the rope, and he's choking me. And as the referee pushes Bobby Duncombe back, Bobby Heenan's sitting there, and he's got a big glass of Coke, and he looks at me. He throws the Coke in my face, and he says, I can't take any more of this boring match. I'm going back to the locker room. And he left, and I was furious. I had Coke all over my face and dripping, and we had to go another 10 minutes, and I come into the locker room, and he starts laughing. I said, you son of a bee. Jimmy, he says, that's the biggest reaction we got out of the crowd. And I said, yeah, at my expense.
That's great. I've heard a lot of good things about it. I mean, I tell you what, when I was a kid, him and Nick Bockwinkel, they would just – that's what they did, though. That's what was their job. But, boy, they'd get me so upset. My grandma would be like, Brian, it's fine, you know. And I'd be like, man, that Nick, he's so mean, and he talks down to people and – Bobby and they did their job.
Nick was probably one of the top three or four workers in the business, period. Yeah. I mean, he was just so, he had the total package. He had the looks, he could work, he was incredible. Yeah. And he could do the interviews, and he humanoid, 8 to 5 lifers and whatever. And it was sad because at the end, you know, he had Alzheimer's, and he'd call me a couple times and in the same day and forget he called. And, you know, he was, and then he had Ray Stevens, who was another brilliant guy. God, started when he was 15 years old. And here's a joke, and I don't know if I'll tell you this, but.
All right.
He says, Jimmy, did I ever tell you about the first time I got laid? And I said, no. And he says, yeah, I was 14. And I said to him, how was it? And he says, I was too drunk to remember. That was Ray Stevens.
Yeah, I heard he liked to party.
Oh, God. He could be drunker than hell. And 2 hours later, he could do an hour Broadway. And he could smell the vodka out of his mouth, but he just boom, 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 you know, and he smoked like a, but he never got tired. God, he was just so incredible in the ring. He was such a natural. Yeah. Jeez.
Wow.
Very nice. Good.
Let's talk about some broadcasters. I know you were around like Mean Gene.
Yep.
Marty O'Neill.
Yep.
Roger Kent. What's your take on, from, let's say, in the AWA when you were there, and then when you went to the WWE, did you see a difference, better, worse, the same, or?
Well, Gene Okerlund was the very best.
Yeah.
I mean, Marty O'Neill set the stage, and then Roger Kent did. He filled in, and he had that illustrious voice, you know, that deep voice. But Gene Okerlund he tied the whole thing together. I mean, he was spectacular. Yeah. I mean, I was so privileged to have Bobby Heenan and then at the same time, Gene Okerlund and then Nick Bockwinkel and all these other guys. And you know, when they went to the WWE, Brian, they do interviews, you know, 12 hours. And Gene Okerlund, I mean, and then nothing was written down. And Gene Okerlund had come and he just bang. And he just was incredible. And he could sense when things weren't working well, and he'd help. He was so good. He was a genius. And then I remember we'd see him. He lived in Siesta Key in Sarasota. And we'd go down and see him. And at the end, he had some ongoing problems with water retention and it was I'll tell you this too. I went to his funeral, and there was 14 people there.
What?
That's it. None of the bigwigs from WWE were there. Vince wasn't there, Hulk wasn't there, nobody was there. And I was furious. And there was only three or four wrestlers. There was Brian Blair, myself, and the same thing happened to Bobby too. Nobody came.
What?
And I said, I made the comment to Brian Blair. I said, where the hell's all everybody? So apparently Vince had called Genie Okerlund about 4 days before the funeral and said, Jeannie, don't worry about nothing. I'm going to take care of everything. And she said to Vince, don't worry, you already have. Oh. So he took that. So he just said, nobody goes.
Wow.
That's
terrible.
Furious.
That's terrible.
Yeah, here you got the greatest manager of all time and that frickin'.
Yeah, that's terrible to hear. Yeah.
You know what? I got one little thing that I'm going to tell you, and it's a little bit political.
Go for it.
Okay, here's the deal. I know this to be a fact. This will be true, that Donald Trump and Vince McMahon, when they want water in hell, they're not going to get it. That's the end of my commentary.
Okay.
Now Brian Blair would say, oh, Jimmy, why did you say that? For God almighty, our wrestling fans are Trump fans. Please don't say that, Jesus God.
Oh, it's all
Brian
right.
At all? Have you talked to Brian at all?
No. If you want to... If you could talk to him and I can reach out to him, I don't want to see when you guys, and I love it. Thank you for sending the emails out to me, you and Greg both. And I see the names on there, but I don't want to, I feel like if I reach out without asking or saying something, that it's just impolite and rude. Cause you know, they probably get a bunch of mail from people that they never heard of. And I don't want to be that guy that is rude or, you know, and looks disrespectful. I don't do that. But well, if you say, If you tell Brian, hey, this guy, if you wouldn't mind, would like to talk to you, I would more than happy to do it.
Well, here's the deal. People like you, Brian, are so important to the revitalization of guys like me who've been out of wrestling and Greg, you know, for 40 some years. I mean, you keep the life, the little spark burning, you know, because I remember, you know, people will come up to me. And they'll say, you know, they'll look at me and I say, oh boy, you know, and then they'll look at me and they'll come up and, you know, and the worst place this can happen is a bar, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't frequent bars anymore, but I used to, and I remember this one guy, he looked at me and he thought for sure he knew me, you know, so he came up to me and he said, he clipped his fingers. He says, I know you. And he says, but I can't picture you. And I said, so I asked him, I says, were you in Stillwater State Prison in 1982? I was there for 6 years. And he looked at me, and he turned away, and he walked away. So I didn't have to bother with him anymore.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's wonderful. No, you know, I started this because, I'll be honest, it was a hobby, and I reached out to Greg first. And, you know, I didn't think he'd write back, or he might take a couple weeks to respond, but he was probably like in 10 minutes. And then when he said that he was going to talk to you, I was like, oh, my gosh, that's great because you guys are one of my favorite tag teams. And, you know, I just wanted to keep the ball rolling with it. So, yeah, if you want to reach out to Brian and if it's okay, you just let me know and I'll email him and ask him and stuff. But I just don't want to be rude. You know, some guy emails you that you don't know and you're like, yeah, who's this guy? I ain't going to talk to
him. Well, I appreciate that. And I think the guys appreciate it when somebody, you know, sets your name up, you know, as have done, you know, done a podcast with me or Greg or something like that. And you'd be surprised how much it means to us, like I said, being out of the business for, you know, 30 years.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then all of a sudden you'll see a tick in my blurb account for, you know, Matlands, you know, the book being sold, you know, I'll sell 10 books, you know, after a podcast, you know, and this adds up and, you know.
Oh, it's a great book too. And I'm going to put it on the bottom of my description, the website and
the book
and everything. So, I mean, you know.
Well, you know, it's funny because some guys write books, but they don't write the book. They have ghostwriters. I wrote every word of that book by myself and we had it, you know, edited. My wife did all the typing, put everything together. We had the, you know, the god dang master or whatever they call it, the big god dang thing was about this thick. And, you know, when I first got it, we had one hardbound. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I was trying to find somebody that could publish it, you know, because it's hard to find somebody to publish your book if because they want money.
Yeah.
And then many of the guys, you know, will have a ghostwriter and then that's incorporated and then they get you know, $2 out of the sale.
Right.
So this way it works out good. And I've had people stop at my driveway in a car and they'll see me out in the yard and they said, "You got any books with you?" You know? I sold two yesterday.
You know? It's a great book. It really is. It's really simple. It's down to earth. It's not, you know, it flows well. I read it in 2 days, if that tells you anything. That's how interested I was in the book.
Well, I wanted to make it easy to read and with the pictures and the stories.
You did.
And, you know, a lot of people say, "Well, why didn't you do this and why didn't you add that?" And I say, "I don't want to do that."
No.
I mean, I would never infringe on anybody, you know, saying something that might be true, but at the same time casting a bad light on somebody. So,
it's a great book. It really is.
I sent two of them to Bruce Springsteen. I don't know if he ever got them. My main man.
I read about him in your book. Let's talk about him a little bit since we're on the subject. You met him.
Yeah, God, he was, and that was like a dream come true in that, like I tell in the book, I was coming home late on a plane ride and I was listening to music. It was 2 o'clock in the morning and I heard the song and I thought, God, who the hell was that? Mm-hmm. And it was operatic. It was Jungle Land by Bruce and they didn't tell the name. So I told my wife the next morning, I said, "Geez, I heard this doggone song. It was incredible." So that 2 days later I heard, you know, Bruce Springsteen, blah, 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 you know. So I went out and got all of his albums.
Yeah.
And I started listening to him all the time, and I told my wife nuts. So he was supposed to play in a celebrity softball tournament the same day that I got hurt.
Oh.
And he was supposed to be there with his crew.
Yeah.
Well, his crew came. He didn't come. He was doing sound check, and we beat the snot out of that team. I mean, they stopped after about two innings. I think it was like 20 to nothing. But – to make a long story short, so I was wrestling when Bruce came to town in 75. I was wrestling in Rockford, so I missed him. And he was at the Guthrie Theater, which I heard was an excellent show. So to make a long story short, I saw him in 78. And then actually when the Born in the USA tour was started in St. Paul, I had so many affiliates that knew me at the St. Paul Civic Center that I just, you know, after the show, we went to every show. It was three shows and we were in the third row in the center. And I remember walking backstage and the cops said, "Hey, Jim." So a guy named Jim McDuffie, who was Bruce's more or less handler then, he comes out to me and he says, "Who are you with?" And I said, "Well," I said, "I'm a pro wrestler from St. Paul," and I said, "I'm a huge fan of Bruce." I said, "Is there any chance of me meeting him?"
Yeah.
And he says, "Well, hang on." So all of a sudden, 2 minutes later, Bruce comes out and he's walking to me. And this president, his guy's name was Yitnikoff, who was the president of CBS Records. And he said, "Bruce, we've been waiting for you for 2 hours." So he comes over to me. And I introduced myself and tell him what a big fan I was. So he takes a picture with Mary and I. And then 2 weeks later, we saw him in Chicago. So I gave him a picture and I signed it to him. And then I had some wrestling pictures. So we wound up, I've seen, I don't know how many times, 80 times, but we'd probably been backstage, 15 to 20. And, you know, he's such a breath of fresh air, you know, because he's so down to earth.
Yeah.
You wouldn't believe that he's almost a billionaire. You know, I mean, he lives good.
Yeah.
He told me, he says, "You know, we live good." It's called Thrill Hill. That's the name of his little production company.
Okay.
And he says, "Yeah, we live pretty good at Thrill Hill." And I can imagine. So, but it's just been, you know, that's been the highlight of my wrestling career, was meeting, you know, how many people can say they meet their hero?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'm with you.
I tried to meet Elvis, but, you know, I was 7, 8 years old and stood at his gated deal, and his uncle or cousin says, Elvis isn't here. And I thought, well, why are 100 people waiting here then?
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you, you know, in the book you talk about meeting him, and it's great. So let's talk about some big cards you were in. You know, you were WrestleMania. Were you in, I can't remember if you were in Super Sunday, the big AWA event back in 83?
Nope.
No, you were not. Okay.
No, Super Sunday, I think, was after I left. I think it was 85.
Okay.
Because I missed a couple big shots there.
Okay.
That they had at the Metrodome, and they had another one. But, you know, here's the problem, Brian. It was, you know, once Hulk left, and then once Bobby left, and once Gene left. And, you know, I'm sure Jesse thought that when he left, he collapsed AWA, but it was far from that.
Yeah.
But it just, you couldn't make any money. They weren't drawing. And at that time, I had my own business. I had Jumpin' Jim Brunzell's gym, and I needed revenue from wrestling. And at that time, and I make this pretty apparent in the book, when I went up to Vern and said, Vern, I need a personal guarantee, you know, 95 grand, which I thought was reasonable, seeing that he and Greg and I had been teammates for 10 years.
Right.
And Vern says, you're not worth it. That's what he said to me, right?
Yeah.
Eye to eye. And it just crushed me.
Yeah.
I just thought, God. So I left.
Yeah. What now, working in W, in the book, you talk about working in there some, if you want to elaborate. I know, from what I understand in the book, you and Vince McMahon didn't see eye to eye on things. And, if you want to elaborate, I mean, I don't want to get too deep into it if you don't want to.
The first thing is that, when I was leaving the AWA, Greg signed a contract with LGN Toys to have High Flyer Dolls meet up, and he signed my name on it.
Yeah.
So knowing that I was going to leave, so I didn't know that. So when I go to the WWE or WWF, and they're going to put the Killer Bees together, and they're going to make dolls, action figures, and all of a sudden this LGN High Flyer Doll comes up, and Vern says to me, "What's this?" You know, and he shows me this package. I said, "I don't know anything about it." So what had happened was, Greg and everybody who signed with LGN got $12,500 to sign up against, you know, future royalty. So because I had signed a contract with Vince, he took the $12,500 himself. And I said, hey, I said, that's my money.
Yeah.
So I sued him and we got the money. So that was in the first 3 weeks I worked for him. So he didn't like me at all from there.
Wow.
So, and see, Brian didn't even know about that until we got fired, you know, when we left in 88. He didn't even know that. He said, why didn't you tell me? And I says, Brian, it wasn't any of your business.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, you know.
Do you think that's why you guys never got the opportunity to hold the tag team titles in WWE, just because of the animosity? Because you guys were great. I mean, you guys were awesome.
Well, we had something that nobody else had, and we were using a heel gimmick with the mask to beat the heels. Nobody had ever done that, and it went over. Over like son of a gun. But the problem was, Vince didn't like me, and he didn't like Brian. Period. Both, and that's the truth.
I just don't understand, if he didn't like you, why did he keep you for 3 years? I mean, because
he knew we fit into the package.
Yeah.
You know, we fit in, you know, we could work with anybody, and we did. And he just, he was hard to deal with in that. One time I was talking to Hulk, and I said to him, you know, about Vince, and Vince is, you know, he's had a lot of shit come down on him, you know, throughout the years, different stuff that's really questionable.
Yeah.
And I asked Terry, I said, what's this, Vince, I says, all this stuff, you know, that's come out, and is, you know, is it, and he told me, he said, Jim, he said, Vince McMahon is capable of anything and everything. That's all he said. And that's all he had to say.
Yeah.
So, and I had an idea at the end. I said, Vince, I got a great idea. I says, why don't I do an interview? You come out and say something to me and let me beat the shit. And you can beat me in the ring. And he said, no, I don't think that'll happen, Jim. You knew that I was, you know, I'd say, who yeah, beat the shit out of you, and then I'm gone, brother.
Yeah. Wow. That is good. So you said earlier you worked with other promotions. I know you worked in the Mid-Atlantic, and you were actually the Mid-Atlantic champion twice.
Yep.
But you said, now Greg told me a story when you guys were down in Atlanta with Barnett.
Yep.
So what was it like working in the Mid-Atlantic when you were the champ? And, I mean, I've heard horror stories about paying and stuff like that and different
Here's the deal. George Scott was the booker down there.
Mm-hmm.
And we wrestled every single day, sometimes twice on Saturday and twice on Sunday.
Yeah.
And they weren't real, you know, the longest trip was, Richmond, Virginia, which was like 210 miles or 220 miles. But the problem was he worked you to death. And then I remember I worked a deal with Cosro and Iron Sheik, and he beat me for the Mid-Atlantic Heavyweight Championship. So we're having a return match. And before the return match, I had a match with him on TV, and I wound up getting a sleeper on him, putting him out, and then taking off his boot, grabbing his boot. And I, you know, I'm making these interviews with his boot for the towns I'm going to be in. So the first town is Roanoke, Virginia, 3:00 the next week. So that's the main event, and they had a great house there in Roanoke. So I'm wrestling Cosro, and I got the boot on. And Sandy, George's brother, says to me, did you get the finish? And I said, no. I said, George didn't mention anything. And Sandy says, well, you're going to do an hour Broadway. I said, what? He said, an hour Broadway. I said, you might as well dig a hole right in the middle of the ring and bury Jim Brunzell, because if I can't beat Cosro with his gimmick boot, what else is there? And I was furious.
Yeah.
And so we did an hour Broadway, and it was like pulling teeth. And then that night, I had to go to Charlotte and do 45 minutes with him.
Oh, no. So,
yeah, the same night. And then he wound up getting disqualified or something, running out. But so then we had this Franklin, North Carolina, and it was a Native American place, and you know, it was just a spot show. So he says, Sandy Scott says, well, the finish is a hour draw, you know, in a spot show, hour draw. So we're wrestling the match, and all, you know, Cosro does something. He said, oh, my back. I says, what's the matter? He said, I hurt my back. So we wound up going about 40 minutes, and then he got disqualified. Yeah. So the next day I get a call from George Scott, and he says, come on in. I need to talk to you. So as I'm walking in, I see Cosro leaving. So I said to George, what's the matter? And he says, well, you know, I told you to do a Broadway. And I said, yeah, but Cos, you know, hurt his back. And that's why we went early. And he says, no, Cos said he didn't hurt his back.
Oh, no.
So he fired.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my gosh.
Fired me. Yeah.
Wow.
And then when I went to New York, George Scott was a booker. So I said to him, I says, oh, Christ. He says, don't worry, Jim. We're starting on a fresh page.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said earlier, I could not believe that you and B. Brian Blair did not ever hold the tag team titles, at least for a short period of time. You guys were amazing. I was trying to remember if you did or not, and I looked back.
Our first match we had, I think, with the Mass, was in Buffalo, New York. It was on TV, and we wound up beating the Hearts. And the people went crazy. Ugh, they went crazy. Yeah. And then little did we know, they were going to take the belts away because we put the mask on or whatever. And, I mean, the people went nuts. And I thought, God, this is going to be, it's going to get over.
Yeah.
And then what Vince did during the course of the next couple of years, he did everything to diminish the value of the mask. There was an 8-man tag. This is the honest to gospel truth. It was in Lake Placid, New York. And it was George the Animal Steel, Coco Beware, Brian, and myself. And at the end of the match, all four of us had Killer Bee masks on. And it was, I looked at Brian and I says, that's it, Brian. I said, the Killer Bees are dead.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then shortly thereafter, it was just Vince's way of,
doing things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Now, if Brian should see this podcast, you'll see, geez, why do you say those bad things about Vince? Because they're true.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. I mean, he's the, is he still the president of the Cauliflower Alley Club?
Yes, he is.
Okay. Yeah, I read that. I try to read up on you guys as best I can to come in with a, kind of known how you guys are. And because like I said, as a kid, I just loved you guys. I mean, you guys just, you're the, what I consider the trailblazers of the business for today. I mean, you guys didn't make nearly the money that these guys make now. I mean, not even close. Oh. If I'm wrong, tell me I'm wrong. But
no.
I'm gonna say.
Well, I got to tell you, we're in New York. This was the last time we were together, and this was in March 6th, 7th, and 8th. We had to do Long Island, Queens, and then we had to go way up to Albany. So it's funny because we're doing a podcast at night, and this guy is asking us about, the fact that we work, 27 days a month, average for 3.5 years.
Yeah.
And he asked Brian, he says, well, how much money did you make? And Brian says, $250,000. And I almost fell off the chair because we never made $250,000. We made $105,000. Yeah. And he said $250,000. And I thought, what in the world are you doing? So I said to him, and he sort of ignored me after that. I said, why would you tell him $250,000?
Yeah.
But it is what it is.
It is what it is. Wow. So
he's going to find out now, because when if they ever go to book us again, as the Killer Bees, I'm asking $2,500 in appearance.
That's
period.
Right. That's right. There
and
you go.
You know what? I won't get any. And neither will he.
So, Jim, did you do anything else in the business besides wrestling? Did you do any booking or no, nothing?
There was some time that I offered my, years of, and I got along good with the fellows, and, I got along with the management there except for Vince.
Right.
And that's the most important. So, yeah. I just wouldn't kiss his ass, and I never did get, any opportunity. And, some of the guys like Steamboat and a couple other guys wound up being agents like for 25 years.
Yeah.
They still traveled, but they made good money.
Yeah.
I think even at the end, they might even had some benefits.
Yeah.
Which we never had,
Right.
You never had a benefit, and you never knew what you were going to make.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, Brian and I sued Vince and won because, on a royalty deal, this contract, outside revenue, we signed this contract, we were supposed to get 25% of outside revenue, which was a great price.
Yeah, yeah.
What they found out through the lawsuit, Vince paid us 8% of the net.
Oh.
So he owed literally hundreds of thousands of dollars to the talent.
Yeah.
And that was really the – well, that this happened, 10, 15 years ago, and, we had to part of the deal was that we wouldn't ask for any royalties, that were due us.
Right.
And you know, I just talked to Patera the other day, and I said, what was your last royalty check? And he says, well, it was $2.50. I got it 4 months ago.
Oh, my gosh. $2.50.
Yeah.
That's too bad. I mean, it's sad that, because you guys, I know those figures sell. If they even brought them, I mean, they probably don't sell them too much anymore. I don't know. But, you know, if they brought back a golden age era of wrestling, the 70s and 80s, and you guys, they featured you guys, you know, licensing and all that stuff, and they said 25%, they'd make a killing.
Oh.
I know they would.
Well, I know that we were told by our lawyers that all the guys should have gotten at the very least over $250,000 on royalties.
Yeah,
just for the dolls.
Yeah.
And I think we got about 12 to 15,000.
Yeah. That's too bad.
That's how the rich get richer.
Apparently, yeah. I'm sorry to hear that. That's just
well, that's part of the crazy world of wrestling.
Yeah. We already kind of touched on this a little bit, but talk about the difference from when you started to today in wrestling. Obviously, more scripted. Do you think the talent is as prepared as you were when you came? Let's say they go to the wrestling school or wrestling performance center, wherever, and they get on the main roster. Do you think they're prepared like you were?
Well, they're prepared as far as they've been taught.
Okay.
You know, they've gone through a series, you know. But here's the main thing, Brian, is when I started, there was 26 different territories you could wrestle in this country.
Yep.
You know, and that was all over. And guys that go to California and spend 2 years, and then they go to Oregon and spend 2 years, and go to Oklahoma and spend 2 years, and Texas. And that's what guys did. And then when Vince consolidated everything, there was no place else to work.
Yeah.
You couldn't – I mean, you have your indies here and your indies there, but you can't make a living doing that, you know.
No.
So Vince was the only game in town.
Yeah.
So consequently, there's a lot of talent probably out there, but – they're conformed to address their talent in the way that the WWE is subjecting them to. So if they don't conform to that, they ain't going anywhere. I know a guy, he played football at Minnesota. His name was Mike Rollis, and he's I'm trying to think of the name. He's been down at that, whatever it is, that training deal down in Florida for 5 or 6 years already.
Yeah, that's
and
yeah.
I'm trying to think of
his NXT. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, trying to think of his name now. Roe or Bit and something Roe, M Roe or something. I don't know. But the fact that you know he's been struggling for 6 years.
Yeah.
I mean. You know, you look at you look and say, oh, even though, you know, they're paying those guys like 85 to 95 grand a year.
Yeah.
You know, to be in NXT, which is, that's a hell of a living. You can't find a job that make that much now, you know.
No. No, you're right. It's.
I've shown a couple podcasts.
Not this one. I can tell you that.
I'm just kidding.
I know you are. Riddick.
That's the guy.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I've heard of him. Yeah,
nice looking, good body, 245.
Yeah, I've heard of him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But 5 or 6 years, geez, if you don't make it in 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
I hope he saved his money.
Right. I don't know if you ever heard of Eric Young. Have you ever heard of him?
Yes.
Okay. Well, he was in TNA. I'm just going off story here a little bit. And he was a world champion there for a while, and tag team and all that. Then he went to WWE, and he was stuck in NXT for 5 years, 5 or 6, I think it was. He finally went back to what's called Impact now, Impact Wrestling, and he did an interview probably a month ago, saying that basically, you know, he was a major star before, and then they kind of just put him in the mid-card stuff. And he said that organization pretty much kind of lacked leadership in his eyes, because the only person I've ever seen that went from Impact or somebody like that to WWE that went onto the main roster was AJ Styles and Robert Roode. The rest of them, most of the time, and Drew McIntyre, I'll take that back. Mm-hmm. The rest of them are stuck in NXT land, and I don't know why. I don't know if it's like a rib saying, yeah, you're here now, but you're going to stay down here. You're not going to get on the main roster. I mean, yeah, you're making 85, 90 grand, like you said, but money isn't everything, at least not in my eyes. I mean, you got to enjoy what you're doing too. And maybe they do. Maybe they want to be at that level. I'm not sure.
Well, those guys are all chasing the dream. They want to be big stars on TV. Yeah. That's their main deal. I mean, that's it. I want to be on I want to be on Raw. I want to be on,
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, the fact that, they're making a decent living, I guess, is some compensation. But the fact that if they're down there 5 years or 6 years, the likelihood of them getting a good spot in the WWE is not very likely.
Right.
If something happens, but, who knows?
Yeah. I'm just hoping some more of these organizations start popping up. Like, we have AEW now. And,
yep. Well, that guy, that Khan, has got – he's worth about $5 or $6 billion.
Right.
He's got more money than Vince.
Right.
But, then, it's funny. I was always hoping that they would do well. But when I watched their presentation, it looks like the WWE. I thought, do something different, for God's sakes.
That's – yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they got Cody Rhodes, and they got Jericho.
Yeah.
I met Jericho when he was first starting. I don't know how many years ago that was. But Jericho was a good kid. I mean, he was a good worker, everything. He could do everything, from Winnipeg.
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't know. These guys that Greg, I think Greg really would love to have a job with the WWE. If he could have a job, I know he calls – what's her name?
Stephanie.
Daughter.
Yeah.
And I just cannot imagine, because Vince hated Vern.
Yep.
Because he was competition, and he would never. They worked. Greg worked for him for a little bit. In wherever the hell it was, Georgia or something, and in a training camp, and. Greg booked the system. He booked the whole, he bucked it. He kept on saying, well, that's not right. And he didn't play ball, and pretty soon they just lopped him off,
He mentioned that. He talked about that a little bit. And, I feel bad for him, because I think Greg's a great guy. I mean, I talked to him. He's a great guy.
He knows the business. I mean, he knows the right way for the business to run.
Yeah.
But there's nobody out there with open ears.
Yeah. You're right. Absolutely. I agree with you. I think they should bring back some of these old school guys, and like yourself and Greg, and to run or book, whatever you want to call it, and see how it takes off. I think, it's been a 30, 40 year hiatus of, eye candy and, the fundamentals, I think are lacking. But, I was going to ask you this question, but you kind of already answered it about the royalties, so we won't get into that again. I don't want to stir up any trouble with you.
Yeah, that's okay.
Your book, I just want to talk about a little bit. How long did it take you to write it? Things of that nature. I've read it, like I said, numerous times on this podcast. It's a great book. Talk to me about what gave you the idea to write it and how long it took and things of that nature.
When we would socially get together with other couples, mm-hmm. After a couple glasses of wine or something, I'd start talking about, wrestling stories. Mm-hmm. And a couple of my friends said, you should write a book about this. So what I did was, over a course of 5 years, mm-hmm. I would remember different stories that I thought people would enjoy. So I wrote them down and wrote a little bit. And then I had, my wife got me this little dictaphone, so I'd talk into that. So finally, it was right, you know, 2015 to start this thing. So we started, and then I compiled the pictures I have. You know, we just went through 33 years at our house here of all cleaning out of this loft in our garage, and I had, I don't know, I swear, 10,000 pictures.
Oh, I believe.
And going through it, and it brought back memories. And then, so we just sort of put that thing together, and then, like I said, we had it edited a couple times, and then boom, you know.
Yeah.
And I was told by other people that wrote books that said, hey, you're not going to be a millionaire, you know, and the only way that you can really do this is if, you know, somebody were to like the book and publish it and have it at Barnes and Nobles and then bring you around, you know, to all the cities, and then you could sign at Barnes and Noble. And, you know, but if I would have gone, I still could go with Barnes and Noble, but you cut your profit down, Brian.
Yeah.
About 50-60%.
Oh, wow.
You know, instead of making $10 a book, you're making like $350.
Oh,
you know, so why do it?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You'd have to, you know, if you sold 20,000 books, it'd be okay, but,
yeah,
you know, the chances are that you're not, you know, and I just, you know, happy with my book, and now they have, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but they have this Squared Circle comic book series.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen it on the internet a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so they just came out with our third. Brian had one, I had one, and then they have the Killer Bees third one.
Okay.
And they just had a Kickstarter, so I think they need like, I don't know, $4,000, and I think in 2 days they got close to $2,000.
Oh, wow.
For it, so I'm sort of looking forward to that. And it was funny, though, because when we went ahead with this, I told the guy, I said, you know, he gave me a proposed cover of the comic, and it had me doing a flying elbow. And I said, John, I said, I do a drop kick. I said, the hell with the flying elbow.
Yeah.
So they make a special copy with the drop kick on it, and it's not, you have to pay extra to get it. Oh. And I said, John, that is the one I want, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
I said, I probably threw, you know, 10 flying elbows in, you know, 25 years.
Right.
But I threw 10,000 drop kicks.
I was going to say, yeah.
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 By the way, I'm having my fourth procedure on my knee Wednesday. There. I've had, in January, I'm having my right shoulder replaced. So I have both shoulders, one hip, and both knees. And my right knee, I'm having my fourth procedure on.
They're doing
what they call, it's 10X. And they numb your knee up, and then they go in with a ultrasonic needle, and they chop up all the scar tissue, and they suck it out. And then that's both to aid in healing and help blood flow.
Yeah.
Because I've had absolutely nothing but problems with this right knee. So hopefully that'll be the trick.
I'm sorry to hear that. I hope it goes well. I don't know. You know, Greg just had back surgery
a
month ago.
And isn't it funny? It wasn't related to wrestling. I mean, he fell in the doggone parking lot of his you know, car lot and had such horror. I mean, you know, his fifth surgery on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jesus.
It's too bad. It's, I know you guys, you know, when I was a kid, I remember saying, people say, oh, that's fake and everything. I said, those guys. You know, and then when I talked to you guys about it, you know, the going into the ropes, Greg told me, you know, that your skin builds up to it because you're just cut to shreds basically when you're first doing it. It's crazy.
Well, it's like anything else. If you do something enough, and like I would say, if you got up in the morning and stood up and felt flat on your back every morning for 20 years. At the end of 20 years, you'd have some serious damage on your back.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true.
So, and I think I jumped. Yeah, I think the jumping and stopping and starting and stuff like that played a lot of wear and tear on both knees. And the fact that my drop kick, when I come down, I landed on my forearm, and it served as a shock absorber. And it just absolutely, completely ruined my shoulder.
Yeah.
The shoulder joint was just nothing but mush. So.
Wow. Also learned that you were inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame in 2013.
Yes.
That's quite an honor.
It was. I was very elated. I know Brian is disappointed, as he should be, that we haven't been in the WWE. You know, I think that was just a deal, you know, a tweet by Vince, you know, because all of a sudden you're getting these guys like the Rock and Roll Express from Tennessee and Georgia getting put in the Hall of Fame, and then, you know, not even, you know, not us, and, you know, people say, and then Brian says, well, you know, you shouldn't have started trying to say you needed a union and you shouldn't have done this. And I says, Brian, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, but I thought that, you know, if someday down the road they say, hey, you know, Jim, we want you, you know, we're going to induct you in the Hall of Fame. And I said, well, I'd like to do it both with the High Flyers and the Killer Bees together.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I ain't going to do it, you know, because my wife said,
I heard her.
Because she heard you got $8,000. So, no, I'm just kidding. You know, that's what they pay you. Hillbilly Jim told me that they paid him $8,000 round trip first class and a suite at the hotel.
Oh wow!
And you know, which is great.
Yeah.
But right now, you know, it's very unlikely. I think that the Killer Bees or the High Flyers will get inducted, but that's okay.
Yeah, he don't like Greg either. I don't think too much.
No.
So tell us a little bit about that award, the Frank Gotch. I tried to look up what it. I know who the wrestler is, but
yes.
Kind of the background of the award. What is it? What is it for?
Well, I think it's a combination of, you know, outside the ring what you've done and inside the ring and the affiliations you've done and what have you. It was, you know, it was nice, and they have a couple different awards there, and I think Brian got one. Brian Blair.
Mm-hmm.
Got one in 2016. He got the wrestling one.
Okay.
And you know, I voted for Greg, you know, a number of years, and they won't get him in there.
Yeah.
So, and you know, it's hard to be the son of a promoter, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's.
And that was a horrible, you know, you look at Mike Graham being the son of Eddie Graham, and then. You have, you know, Greg being the, you know, son of Vern. Then you have the Von Erichs from, you know, Fritz Von Erich. And it's just, you know, those fathers built such a animosity against the family, you know, just from being who they were.
Yeah.
You know, it created a lot of hostilities and negative, you know, images of their offspring. So they just,
It's tough to be when, like, Vern was so good and Eddie, and it's hard to.
Oh God.
Be above or not above them, but at that level and try to get.
Yeah.
I mean, there's only a few guys, Randy Orton.
Yes.
You know, he's great.
He was one of the top five.
Yeah. Randy Orton.
Jake Roberts too.
Jake the Snake.
Yes.
It's just hard to compete with when you got, you know, your father is such a legend, and you try to compete with that. It's hard. I couldn't even imagine it. So I don't have a famous parent, so I'm good. You're a famous guy, so I'm sure.
Well,
your son isn't in wrestling, but I'm sure when they say Jim Brunzell, oh, is your dad the wrestler? And he's like,
Yeah. Well. Thank God that, you know, there's, you know, I've been, like I said, I've been fortunate, Brian. You know, I've had a blessed life, a great family, great wife, great kids, you know, and that's all you can ask for.
Yeah. I mean, in the book, you talk very highly of your wife, Mary, your son, Jim the third, and he's a film.
Yes.
He does
film. He's a great film festival, and he critiques, and he's you know, managed two films for 7-8 years, and
yeah,
he just loves that business, and he
don't look that old.
Well, he's 41.
Is 40. He really?
Yeah.
Good and he Lord.
Said, yeah, he said that when he was like 7 or 8 years old, he said he was going to be a film critic. Well, yeah.
Well, and you have a daughter as well, correct?
Yes, my daughter works. She's works for the school district. She's in charge of the whole curriculum for the White Bear Lake school districts from K to 12. So she's got a lot of stress on her this year.
Well, yeah, especially this year with this virtual stuff.
Oh, God, it's horrible. Horrible, yeah. And then we have two grandsons with Jenny and Chris, her husband. Mm-hmm. And my grandsons are in the picture that with Hulk.
Yep. Yeah.
Cal Becca James, excuse me. Thank you.
That's all right.
You know, after a couple, an hour or so, my mind is going.
Along. I'm sorry. I don't mean to take up.
No, that's
time.
Okay. That's okay. But
tell your wife, Mary, if you can hear me, I'm sorry. I don't mean to take up too much of his time.
He apologized for taking up too much of my time. He said no.
Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one more question.
Okay.
What are you doing now? What are you up to? Are you still working for that?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm working for a janitorial sales company. I've been doing this 21 years now, and the company is called Delco Enterprises.
Okay.
And they're located in New Brighton, which is a suburb of St. Paul, Minneapolis. And we have 5 branches, and this company – did $76 million last year. So
oh my goodness.
It's a big company, and right now in the middle of this pandemic, you know, being in the business of supplying sanitizer and disinfectants and different trigger sprayers and bottles and electrostatic disinfectant units, we had a $6 million back order month in August.
Oh, wow.
$6 million that we weren't able to fill because of the supply chain.
Yeah.
So it's been sort of hit or miss. And I'm fortunate. They hired me. The general manager was a collegiate wrestler at Wyoming. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed with him, you know, 21 years ago. And the clear blue sky, the fellow with him, who was sort of my mentor, asked me a question. He says, "Jim, can I ask you a question?" I said, "Sure." He says, "How did it feel when you went out in the ring in front of all those people and wrestled in your underwear?" And I looked at him, and then my boss says, "You're hired." So
that's great. That's great.
So I've been doing that. I figure maybe another year, and hopefully I'll be able to retire.
Well, good for you. I am so happy, and we're going to close this out. I just want to thank you again for doing this. It's been an honor and a pleasure. And, you know, I live if I ever pass through there, which I will here in a few months, going to see my parents, my wife and I.
Okay.
If you guys are available, we'd love to maybe stop and have lunch with you and your wife or something.
Sure.
Or whatever you want to do. So
I'll send you my – did I send you my telephone number?
I don't have your telephone number, sir. I do have your address. Whenever you get a chance, if you want
to,
I'll
give you a
call.
Yeah, I'll send you that. But
okay.
It's been my pleasure, Brian. You do a nice job.
Well, thank you.
Very personable. So, I you know, I enjoyed it.
Thanks. Enjoyed it, too. Thank you. I'm going to cut it off at here and – thank you again. I really appreciate it, sir.
Okay.
All right.
God bless.
Thank you.
Hey, this is a Total Package of Lex Luger, and you're listening to the VOC Nation. Don't miss out.
Since 2018, there's only been one program that brings you artists from around the world, both big and small, brings you the best in local talent, and hosts live events. Rock and Roll Union is all of that and more. With C.T. McManus, the Lovely D, and new co-host Psycho Steve Preston, you're sure to get everything you need. So tune in Mondays at 6 p.m. for your one-stop shop for all things rock and roll. Rock and Roll Union, music worth fighting for.
Check out in the room.
Every Tuesday night at 9, listen in.
Pro Wrestling Illustrated's Brady Hicks, former WCW star Stro Maestro, Kazzy Fist, Matt Grimm.
And you and Ray are there too, right, Ray?
We sure are, and we've got great guests like Lex Luger, AJ Styles, Taku, and more. It's a heck of a party. Plus,
I didn't get thrown off buildings.
And then
I didn't get pregnant either.
Sometimes I think it gets so ridiculous.
We were getting into, like, snuff film territory there.
In the room.
9 p.m. Eastern on VOC Nation.
Wrestling with History, the voice of choice, and Killer Ken Resnick.
When I die, they're going to open me up and find about 2,000 undigested Northwest Airline cheese omelets.
Mr. Chris Cruz, what's going on?
Jesus, how did I get roped into this?
General Adnan went to school with Saddam Hussein.
He cried, I cried, he cried, and who could have
cried? Adnan lost a lot of family in the Iraqi war.
Everybody loves Granny.
Wow. Yeah, see, a lot of people don't know that.
Yes, Taylor, you guys are busting me up.
Catch Wrestling with History with Ken Resnick and I live on VOCNation.com or listen to the podcast by searching VOC Nation Radio Network on your favorite podcast app.
Each and every Thursday night, check it out. WCW star Stro Maestro takes you on a journey. It's WCW Retro. Talking old school match of the week, talking dream matches, taking your calls and looking back on an incredible career of acting, entertaining, and wrestling. Check it out. VOCNation.com. WCW Retro. Be sure to call in Thursday nights, 9 Eastern, on the VOC Nation Radio Network.
Yo, this is Jerry Stiles of the Nasty Boys. Yeah, Brian Knobs here. You getting ready to get nasty? Well, listen to the VOC Nation, baby, because it's about to get nasty all around and up in this mother. Get ready. Nasty Sensation is coming at you.
The worldwide leader in entertainment. This is the VOC Nation Radio Network.